Want to expand the influence of design? Pragmatic Institute offers interactive, actionable courses for designers who are looking to contribute more strategically in their organizations. Explore our offerings such as Business Strategy and Design and Influence Through Storytelling at pragmaticinstitute.com/design.
And welcome to Design Chats, a podcast from Pragmatic Institute, where we sit down with design leaders, practitioners, and alumni to discuss how to grow the strategic impact of design. I am Rebecca Caligaris, Vice President of Marketing and Product Strategy at Pragmatic Institute. And today I am thrilled to welcome Lori Landsman, VP of User Experience at Salsify and expert in UX design and research in both B2B and enterprise environments, and just an all-around passionate designer who is always looking to help people expand their knowledge. So welcome, Lori. We're thrilled to have you.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. For those who haven't had the pleasure of speaking with you before, Lori, let's give a little bit of the background. How you got into design, what made you so passionate about what you do?
So this is always so hard for me. It's like, where to start? It's been so long. but I started in instructional technology. I got a degree in that and thought that I would be designing educational software. And specifically when I started out, that meant like CD-ROMs. And so it was that was where I started. And in doing educational software, I sort of fell into what was then called the usability world, because I got hired at a company, Netscape, which at the time was like amazing and great. And they were seeing their websites as educational material, instructional devices kind of. And so they liked that I had that background. And then as I got there and started learning about what was going on, I met people on what was then the usability team. And in working with them, it's like, oh, this is actually it. This is what makes a difference. And so then I became a usability expert a usability practitioner from working with them. And that really started me down the road that became user experience design when that emerged. And yeah, it all, like, I can sort of make it make sense in retrospect, but I was sort of falling into things as they were emerging. It was not a well-planned strategy on my part, but it worked out really nicely.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I think that somehow times we all just trip into where we're meant to be. And in the background, you can go like, oh, that's how I got here. Those are all the experiences along the way that made it work. But there wasn't like some fortuitous overly planning, but. And one of the things I think is super interesting, and one of the things I know that you'd like to talk about, is you like to talk about design maturity. And I think, as you've talked about, you can look at it from the perspective of how your career has matured, how design maturity in the organizations you have worked with in advance, and then also just like how design as a function has changed so much from here's your CD-ROMs that you download, as I remember that, to, you know, how, what kind of an integral part of it is of the process for so many companies today. So let's dig into that. Let's talk a little bit about design maturity and how you think about that.
So this is, well, frankly, I think more about UX maturity than design maturity specifically. Yeah. And I think just because I always sort of gravitate towards the more general term. And I feel like if I talk about UX maturity, design fits into that, research fits into that. So I like that kind of model, although it's a little bit of just a semantic difference. And there are tons of maturity models out there, and it is almost a hobby of mine to look and see how different people describe it. I don't necessarily think you have to lock in on one, and I do think that all of them kind of cover the same stuff in slightly different ways. Some are more detailed. There's one that I like a lot from Natalie Hansen, who is an anthropologist, and she has a blog where she, about 5 years ago, detailed a maturity model that makes a lot of sense to me. It's just four steps. Again, I like kind of basic, where it's like, at first, we're not being intentional about it. It's sort of like unintentional design. The next step is more focused on visual design and like, are we doing the right colors, the right branding? The next step is more about understanding, starting to think about users and like, is this usable? Is what we've put out there something that people can figure out? And then the final step is really end-to-end experience of it could be in the product or just the way a user relates to everything that we offer. I like that because I feel like it's general enough where almost any anything can fit into there at some point, and I think we can all relate to it. And yeah, the thing about talking about UX maturity, as much as I love it, it's so complicated. And even when you look at an organization, it's really hard to characterize a full organization. Like different parts of the org will have achieved different levels of maturity. Yep. And so, yeah, it's a good tool to use at almost any elevation to help you understand where are we, where could we be going. But you have to think of it in the right context. Like, first of all, no company goes from the bottom to the top quickly. I think that, yeah, different parts of the organization will progress at different rates. And you have to know too that just because you're at maybe a 3 on Natalie Hansen's model today, it could actually go backwards too. I mean, people change at organizations all the time. Things that you've achieved sometimes get erased because there isn't memory for it anymore. People are gone. You might get new leadership that doesn't like the way things were working before and changes things. And so all of that makes a difference. But I do think it's a helpful way to just get, it's a map. It tells you kind of where you are here. Here's where you could be going next.
I think it's super true too, that like within especially large organizations, there are going to be pockets of different maturity all around. And again, I think so much of UX maturity still is, it's often still sort of a result of a person's or people's advocacy, right? And not as many companies as it may be like already built into all the processes and DNA to the level. So to your point, that makes it easier as personnel change then for there to be a shift in there. But I think it's a good model for a couple of reasons. One, I think it would be really interesting to make sure everyone in the organization has that same understanding of what level you are, so we know what we're talking about and what we're aiming for. And also because the role of a designer and UX, right, in those four areas is very, very different. And if you're bringing in, I'm going to be this kind of UX person in an environment here, you're going to have a big disconnect.
That is so true. And I feel like this is something I end up talking about a lot with other UX people, is knowing what you're getting into when you interview at a place. Like, I think that some of us prefer being real change agents who can get into a place that hasn't realized what UX is and, you know, really start something and get it going. Other people don't want to fight that fight anymore or have those conversations that they've been having for years. And so they want to come into a place where it's more established, where they can just go in and do the work of a designer and actually get something done. And so it is an important thing both for people interviewing UX people coming in to let them know where we are and to make sure that the people who are applying are going to be able to be their most productive selves in that environment. And when you're the person interviewing at an organization, to really probe for that and know what's going to make you most comfortable. What do you want to be doing? And does the organization suit you that way?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about on those kind of four steps, right? The sort of non-intentional to visual designer to really starting to think about user perspective and usability to the sort of end-to-end experience. Let's talk about what the design role and function might look like in each of those.
Okay, so yeah. So in the unintentional design, like at step one, there probably isn't a trained designer in place there. It's like there's a product being put out maybe by front-end engineers or something like that, and it might be working or not, but they don't really have formal training around that. And at some point, someone says, you know, are we doing this right? Should we? And that might be that they've worked with some consultants who have helped them see that there are ways of doing this. They might have hired a marketing person or something who is more aware of what they want the brand to do, but they start thinking more about visual design. I think there are no rules that apply all
right.
the time,
yeah,
but very often it is a visual designer who starts the awareness of design and has an intentional practice about this. These are the colors we should use to just be aligned between our product and our website, or, you know, things like that, having the same logo in different places, you know, whatever. So that often a visual designer will start that. And then perhaps they're getting feedback on their product that things are hard to use or that people can't figure out how to do basic things, or there may even be a business problem, like people are putting stuff in the cart but never actually checking out. It's things like that. And that's mm-hmm. where starting to understand, okay, we might have a problem with people knowing what to do. And this is where I think sometimes you get non-designers hiring designers in to say, like, we need someone, but we're not sure what. And that's, I think those are where you get those weird job descriptions too on LinkedIn or whatever. That it's like, we want someone who can program and do marketing and
the unicorns.
Like, they don't know how to describe what they need. Right. Yeah, they need everything. And so that's where you start, I think, to get either like there, sometimes I think it starts with product managers or a visual designer who understands we need to do more and sort of starts that work and then brings in someone perhaps with more expertise. Again, it could start with a consultant who says like, oh, you know, we could actually do some studies on this to see where people are struggling and do some alternative prototypes and test those out. And it starts, I think, very screen by screen oriented. And often I find once teams see their first usability test, they're sold like, oh my God, if we had only known, like to us, what seemed so obvious is actually not at all obvious to real users. And so then that becomes a practice that multiple teams start using and you end up, or you start moving towards, if the company does well, embedded UX people on different teams, helping teams make those decisions over time. And so what had been visual design morphs into more like interaction design. Maybe you have both of those people working together. Maybe it's one person who does both. And then as you get, as you reach nirvana, you start thinking about not just individual teams, but how does someone move across first a full product journey? And then it's like, oh, wait, this isn't even just relegated to our product. Like there are services we offer in association with that product and what that reinforces what goes on in the product, or our sales cycle actually is showing off something different than what happens in the product. Like really thinking of the full life cycle of customers as well as their end-to-end journey. And maybe it even starts to permeate into other aspects of the company, like how we hire people or the kinds of programs we offer internally. You know, sometimes it's about the way we name our conference rooms, like just all kinds of ways that UX starts to permeate and get beyond individual screens or being feature specific. So yeah, that I think is sort of what it could look like. Although again, everything is different.
But, and I mean, I think you can see just in that conversation how varied it would be and how if you wanted to be in one type of company doing one type of work and you were if you wanted to do one type of work, but you were in a different type of company, it wouldn't be a match for either side. Now, some of that is, yes, I want to do that, but I want to advocate for it. I like that challenge and I want to bring them in, but you have to know that's what you're signing up for and not that it's not going to come in and be in place for you. It won't
exactly
be paved.
Yeah. And it's just, it can be so frustrating. And I've seen this, I have felt it myself. When you get to a place and you think you're going to be doing one kind of work, and in fact, the company wants something totally different and you're just not up for it. And yeah, that just makes for a really unhappy work environment.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things you talk about too, which is one of the things I love talking about, is sort of leadership versus management and how I think that also evolves in this spot and just how important understanding both those sides are.
Yeah. So this, I'm trying to think of how strongly I feel about what I'm about to say. I think that this has a little bit to do with the size of a company, because I think early on, or at smaller companies, it is often the case that leadership and management are the same thing. So if you want to be a leader, you start managing people. But I think as companies grow, those two roles are not necessarily the same thing. And you can be a manager of people who is not necessarily leading a vision. And you can be a leader of a vision who's not necessarily managing people. But that can be really confusing. I'm continually confronted with people getting confused over those two things or thinking they need to move into a people management role in order to be able to really lead something. And I know, like, even right now at my company, I have recently taken some specific actions to separate out people management from leadership, and I have like principal designers who are leading efforts that match up to the kind of pillars of the way we think about how we're moving forward. And it's a newer thing there. And some people just need some help understanding, like, why would you have an individual contributor leading this? And it's like, well, they're really senior and they know a lot about what's going on. And they have the bandwidth that, frankly, people managers often don't have, because people management takes a lot of other work that doesn't necessarily give you the time to really focus on, like, how do I move this thing forward? So I think it makes sense to have both, and it's really good, but it's that also is a thing that is kind of linked to where a company is in its own growth and how, I mean, I think this is a place you have to work with HR too, to really understand, do we have tracks for both individual contributors to move forward and become leaders, as well as people managers to do that and really divide up and understand people's skill sets so they're on the right track.
And I think one of the things I really like about that too, is I think that too often the next career step, the success is, everyone thinks of it as that avenue up through people management and that. And I think it does a disservice to some extent to not recognize exactly what you're talking about, right? That sometimes the right path is just to be a stronger and stronger individual contributor. And that's not a weakness, right? That's not like we need both. And frequently one does have a skill set or a passion in one of those areas over the other.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'm so enthusiastic talking over you. Go ahead.
No. I'm well known for doing that. So yes, no, but yeah, I mean, I think it's being able to play with people's or to people's strengths and passions and give them a feeling of success and accomplishment that isn't necessarily tied to one track or the other, like finding the right one for them.
Yes, absolutely. And I have seen this happen where people think that in order to advance, they need to become people managers. They start down that track and then they realize after a while, like, oh, I miss doing actual design or research, and having to write reviews of people is a massive drag. And this is not for me. And that is not, by the way, it's not an irrevocable decision. I think it's good to try and then understand what it is. It's really hard to know what it is to do a thing until you do it. And so if you have curiosity about people management, that's a fine thing to pursue, but it's also good to know why you're doing it and to do it for the right reasons. And if it's to be perceived as a leader, in many cases, it doesn't have to be the case. And again, depends on your organization. You have to see, like, do they have those tracks and what can you do there? But I know for myself, when I first started as a manager, I absolutely thought it was the route to leadership. And I did it for a while and I got really disillusioned with it. And I stepped back and went back to being an individual contributor. I feel like I was a better individual contributor because then I could empathize more with managers, mm-hmm. and understand mm-hmm. what they needed. So I'm glad that I did that. And then over time I realized, okay, now I'm ready. Now I understand what the value of being a manager is, and I could go back to that track and be better at it and more motivated to do it well. So I think there's value in doing that too.
And I also think in maybe companies that aren't as mature as yours or smaller companies, I think they're still important to understand, even if it's to understand that you don't have to be a manager or have the title to be a leader, especially when we're talking about advocating for design in a less mature company, right? So many times you're like, oh, I can't do it because I don't have the title. And I've coached so many people here. I'm like, it doesn't work that way. You do it and you lead, and that's the title comes after. Like, you don't just suddenly get granted and crowned and coronated on. But I think it's really important to not let your lack of title also keep you from being able to be a leader. You can be a leader from any spot in the organization.
I completely agree. I mean, to be a manager, you have to be promoted into a manager role. But to be a leader, leaders mm-hmm. emerge. You know, mm-hmm. you have to really decide, okay, this is what I am going to do, and start to do that work. And it's going to be different depending on where you are, but you can do it. You can become that if you want to.
Yeah, no. And to me, it's always been one of my favorites, right? Coming up in my career, I think I did it not intentionally, not like I was like, I'm going to lead. I think it happens to be my personality, right? and so it just felt like, oh, come on, I get everybody excited and I can get everybody to change. And at the end of the day, that to me was the most important part. More so than and they all go, Rebecca did that. Like, I mean, I've got an ego. I want a little of that. But yeah, right. Most is like, I want to see the vision realized.
Yeah. No, I think that's the thing is sometimes people don't even realize they're doing it when they are. And I think that's sort of what you described. Like suddenly you realize, oh, there are people who are counting on me to tell them what the next step should be. Like, oh, I am a leader. I need to start actually acting. Yeah. And that's a cool thing to suddenly realize you've been in that position. And I do think that people who care deeply about the work and have a sense of this is the direction we could go in, this is what will help our users and the business and all that, like they are leaders, whether they recognize it or not. And the more you recognize it, the more you can do with it.
And I think there's so many designers that this is a really good spot for, right? The storytelling capabilities and the understanding the users. And I think sometimes what can be most critical for them is helping this really clear vision that we have of the user and the experience and translating that for the rest of the business in language they understand and reasons they would focus on, I think is sometimes one of the hardest parts.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I mean, to me, this is always a little bit ironic. I think that designers, researchers, UX people are so good at empathizing with end users of the product, or not necessarily even end users, but users of a particular product. And they can really convey that to other people so well. But often what I see as a blind spot for UX people is they're not quite as good as empathizing with their peers within the organization and understanding what those people need in order to really embrace what the UX person already knows. And it's not everyone wants to be a designer, but no one wants to put out a bad product.
Nope.
And so understanding like where people are coming from, what their priorities are, how they're seeing the world can help a lot in crafting a persuasive story about why the user experience is important or what we could do right now in order to make the UX better. And I think sometimes toning down, like as UX people, I feel like it all comes from a good place. We care deeply and we know a way that we want to do a thing, but that may not always be the best way or the way that is likely to happen given where we are right now. And so understanding those constraints and who needs to be involved and what they need in order to feel comfortable is another part of the user experience vision that you have to have in order to really deliver what you want to deliver.
Absolutely. I think it's both understanding the business constraints and realities. Just like you said, when you went back to being an individual contributor, you're like, my manager is actually doing things all day, right? Like, wait a minute, that's a really busy role, right? Like there's a perspective piece, but also then it's translating. I think we get so passionate about the user and their success that like, we're like, well, of course we're going to do this because look what it will do for them. And that's true. That is the guiding light for us, but that's not necessarily how we're going to convince our peers, right? So what is the doing that for the user going to do for the business? And that isn't as fun to talk about in some ways, right? It can feel like, but like that is what allows you to do the thing you know is the right thing. And that's what we're talking about, right? Is how do I unlock that to make it a reality?
Right, right. And this has been like, I understand the struggle. The struggle is real. Like, you know, for me, I gravitated to UX because it felt really natural to me. I understand how to do that. It has been harder for me to learn about how does a business work? How do decisions get, who are the different roles? Like I went to get an MBA after I'd been working for a while so that I could get a better, I wanted to be more effective as a contributor to an organization, not just a better UX person. And I'm glad I did that. And I feel like I'm always still learning about how do businesses run, not simply how do good user experiences get crafted. And knowing that has been helpful. And it's like, I'm still learning all the time. I find out new things on a daily basis.
And every company is a little bit different, right? I mean, there are some guiding principles, some things we're always thinking about, but understanding too what makes your company tick, what are the levers that matter to them that you can tie your work to, I think is really critical.
Yes. Yeah, that is so true. And like for me, I've been mostly involved in enterprise software, the technical B2B kinds of software, which is my guess is that's very different than working at, you know, whatever, TikTok or so, you know,
right. Yes.
Different needs. And also, you know, whether you work at a company that has 15 people or 400,000 people or anything in between, that's going to also dictate a lot of what you're able to do. It's another consideration, I think, for any UX person to think about what will be the different kinds of both possibilities and constraints at each size of a company. Like, I would never have known at the beginning of my career how to make that kind of differentiation. But now I know, like, okay, I like to work at companies about this size for these kinds of reasons. And it does make a big difference.
Yeah. So one other aspect of UX I want to talk a little bit about, because, and maybe I'm not right here, but it feels like this is one that is harder to make the space for on those, I keep putting the lower maturity on the left. My imaginary head, this is a left to right axis, just so we're all clear, but is research, right? And advocating and the role of research and UX research in sort of the unintentional all the way to then feels like it's one of the areas that changes the most. And yet it's one of the most criticals.
Yeah. And I think maybe, so I think about this a lot because I care a lot about research. And I think it can mean really different things. And the kind of research that you get empowered to do at different companies, like that is also different. So let's get specific about research. So early on at a company, like when we were talking about stage one before, where unintentional design is happening, like it would be unlikely that any kind of UX research is happening at a company like that. Although they may be doing market research, right? Mm-hmm. They may have, and that's valuable, like knowing things about the market that you want to serve, that's something. But then when you get to more intentional design, like probably not until phase three, that's where research really becomes a priority and intentional, but it's a certain kind of research. It's going to be probably mostly usability testing, maybe having open-ended interviews with people. So focus on really qualitative kind of data, which is great data to have. I think also at that point, people might be thinking about analytics or like, how do people move through our product? Is this fair to say that most companies have some kind of analytics that they're gathering? I think so
at this point. Now, whether or not they're using them is different, but they certainly have the data in a different way than we sure did back in the day, right?
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So that's the quantitative data that I think is common, and usability testing would be the kind of qualitative data. And so they may not even be putting those two together or thinking about the need for a combination of qualitative and quantitative on everything that we're doing, but that's where it starts. And then I think once they get to that place where knowing, oh, okay, qualitative can give us some information about like why people are doing certain things, and quantitative can give us certain information about what people are doing. Like, it would be great if we could combine all of that together.
Right,
and I think where you could start getting to really interesting research, and the more where you wouldn't necessarily have a designer doing the research and design. Like, up until that point, you could probably just have a designer who does the work that you need and can move it forward. But then when you start to think about, no, we need a combination of methods. And also, we don't want to just be reactive to what we've already done. We want to be like looking forward to what we could be doing. Like, that's where you want to start getting people who have specialized research skills. Like, do they know how to do ethnographic research? Do they know how to do statistical analysis on, you know, different experiments that we could run, or larger surveys? That's in places where I have been that have embraced that kind of research, and we could do like jobs to be done analysis, or thinking about how to do clustering analysis on how people are using our software so we could start to do testing. Like, that's really fun. But I do think that that's not any company can just embrace that and start going with it. You need to first really know, like, just is what we're doing right now even good enough? You know, so I think it takes a while to get to that kind of really deep, fun research with specialists.
And I do think like the idea of sort of leveraging data in design is, I mean, it's not new, obviously, but I think our ability to do it and somehow the importance of it in some places is really starting to elevate. I was talking to someone who does game design, and I think it's a great example where there's just so much input and data back. And it was fascinating to think of that loop. And I mean, I think in the B2B and the enterprise space, there's, it's maybe not quite the volume or velocity, but there's still that ability like to take from some of those others and really start to test different things and see different things and break down the type of metrics that we watch that we find really do factor in just a really exciting way.
Oh, absolutely. There's always more you can be doing in terms mm-hmm. of gathering data. And it's hard, I mean, because it does require either instrumentation of a product in order to gather what you want or agreement upfront about what kinds of metrics mm-hmm. will make a difference. Like that's, I think, actually a big hurdle I've seen in places I've worked where researchers start doing a study and like gather some really interesting data, but no one's really willing to react to it. And I realized now like, oh shoot, we didn't spend the time up front to get people bought into what we were doing and what would have to happen based on different kinds of outcomes from that research. And so, yeah, it's, I do think it's tricky to do research, good research in a way that has an impact on what the organization then does. Yeah, because there's all kinds of possibilities, but it requires some investment and you want to get something back from that investment. So how can you plan to make sure that happens?
And with the amount of data we have these days too, there's a lot of like false metrics, right? I could move that metrics, but that metric isn't going to actually move a goal that matters, right? But sometimes it's hard to know which one it is, right?
Exactly, right. I mean, there is trial and error. And I think that you have to, and that's why you want to get upfront that collaboration with cross-functional partners to say, okay, if we see this, we're going to make a change. But then you might not see that. And it doesn't necessarily mean that what you did was bad. And so then you have to decide, okay, do we want to do another experiment to see if we can get at it in a different way? Or are we just moving on from that? Like, it's really hard to know. And that's, I think that's what turns people off to research a lot, is that they want it to give a definitive answer.
Yeah.
It's very rare that you get a definitive answer. It's like we can get an indication of something and decide to move forward or not, let's all be bought into that.
And that's true, because that's one way anybody can sort of fight a data-driven discussion, right? It seems like it's data-driven, you can't fight it, but you always can, because there's always the, well, how many did you actually get? And what about this? And like, there's always ways it's not definitive. And if I want to be the person to stop progress, I can focus on those. But to your point, if we have the discussion up front, we know what are going to be the advantages and the limitations of the type of analysis we can do, then we've already agreed that this level of gray area we're okay with. And that's what we're going to move on.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I'm just thinking, that made me think of something else. So everyone has opinions, and especially if it's about design, right? Like everyone has opinions. And so getting people out of that habit of saying, well, just because you feel strongly about something doesn't make it right. Can we do something to either increase our confidence or reduce the risk associated with mm-hmm. it? And let's talk about that and what we would need to see in order to feel that. And then let's do it. But it's really hard, I think, when people are used to just saying, well, I love blue. It's obviously, it should be blue.
Everything should be blue.
Whatever the thing is. And to get people away from that, because it's a fast way to influence a decision and keep things moving forward.
Excellent. Absolutely. All right. And we did touch along about this, but we talk about the maturity model. And I think you talked about finding the right maturity model or maturity level for you, right? It's a little bit like being a manager isn't necessarily the only answer, right? Talk a little bit about what you would, if you were mentoring someone and they're going to get a new role and they're trying to figure out what kind of new role to focus on, how would you help them kind of work through this process?
I would want to know what projects they've worked on that they really liked and what projects they hated, or not hated, but that made them unhappy, you know, and to really identify what it was about the situations that were positive versus the situations that were negative. And to say, you know, like, for example, like it took too long for us to make any decisions. Everything took forever because it had to go up the hierarchy and get approval and then come back down. It's like, okay, that person may be happier in a smaller company where things can move faster. And so that's like about size of company. If it's about maturity, then it's like, I hated that no one even believed that we should do usability testing, and that we came up with a decision and they wanted to ship it the next week and we couldn't get validation. It's like, okay, so you probably want to be in a more mature organization that already accepts You know, it's like you're not quite ready yet to make the argument for why this needs to happen and do that. So that's another thing to look for. And so, yeah, understanding that about what people like to do. And again, I think some people really like the educational evangelism aspect of things where it's like, I like, you know, getting people, being the person who can lead an effort to really change an organization and show them what, whether it's usability testing or end-to-end journey mapping or something. Like, I want to be the person who leads that. So okay, then in that case, you want to find the place that meets that kind of thing.
Yep.
But the one thing I want to also point out related to that, there is another kind of theory or framework that I've gotten really excited about in the past couple of years that is related to UX maturity models. And that's an idea called the leadership ceiling. And there is a guy I know, it sounds awful, a person who practiced user experience design for like 30 years at Kaiser. His name is Tim Kieschnick. And I know him through professional organizations. I have not actually worked with him directly, but he has proposed this idea of a leadership ceiling where that an organization can only go as far as the leadership allows it to. And so you have to look at who's leading a company and what they're open to know what's going to be possible. And I do feel like that's something to consider as well as you're looking, like you can want to really change a place, but is the place open to being changed? And that I think is a really useful thing to know. And obviously if you're coming in as a UX researcher, you're not going to interview with the CEO, but even knowing for the people you're going to be working with, like there's a local maximum too, right? It's like for those people, are they really open? Do they see possibilities? Are they really happy with the way that they're working right now? What do they want from a UX person? And how well do they feel that they're serving their audience right now? Those are all things you can start to gauge in an introductory interview. And that can help you make some decisions about, is this place at the maturity I want? If not, and I want to get it to a higher maturity, are they going to move in that direction? You know, it's always so hard in an interview, but I do want everyone to know who is interviewing for a job that you're interviewing a place to. It's not them just interviewing you. And you should know based on your past experiences what you want and whether you are likely to get it from this place that you are interviewing with.
Nice. All right, Lori, we talked about lots of different things. So if you were going to have listeners do two things differently tomorrow, based on what we talked about today, what would it be?
I would say, first of all, look carefully at your organization and understand what you think is possible there. Mm. And is it open to what you want to be doing? Like, it could sound like I'm encouraging everyone to quit their job, which I am not.
Are you hiring, Lori? No, I'm just kidding.
I know. But truly, I think that sometimes we either stay at places with unrealistic expectations of what we can achieve, or we're not doing enough to really move the needle. Like there are possibilities there that we haven't even fully explored. So I think that understand your organization and understand how you can make a difference there. You know, how it's not just about you arguing for the user experience more, but like how can you argue it in a way that actually can make a difference? What is the UI? What is your own UI in a way? And how are you making yourself kind of usable for your peers in order to accomplish what needs to be accomplished? I think that those are really important things and can help you be more effective. Like pretend you're doing a site visit at your own company. What do you observe and how can those observations help you be more effective in your own role?
Excellent advice, Lori. I really appreciate the conversation. I had a great time talking with you today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been really fun.
Excellent. All right. One more question, Lori. If people want more of your thoughts, if they want to follow you or get in touch with you, how would you like them to do that?
You know, I don't like have a blog or anything like that. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm always happy to talk to people. Like if people want to reach out that way, that's probably the easiest way to get to me.
Excellent. Perfect. Great. All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. And don't forget to join us next time when we cover another great topic. And if you're looking to learn more about how to contribute strategically, to drive value, to build influence, make sure you check out pragmaticinstitute.com/design.